What's up, everybody? You probably thought we were done with Pacific Rim here at Nerdometrics, but if you thought that, you were wrong, because there's more Pacific Rim goodness on this episode. There's a podcast in the Bay Area called Carry the One that's run by a friend of mine, Sama. So one of my favorite things to say about it is they are dropping science literally. If you haven't checked their stuff out, I highly recommend you check them out. They're at the forefront of a lot of technologies that we all could benefit from. Now, I know Sama, and I sent him an email and said, hey, neuroscience behind Pacific Rim. Like, he's a neuroscience guy. Maybe he'd like to talk about that. And he said, yeah, I absolutely would like to talk about it. And I'm going to call in an expert friend of mine named Joey, who's even closer to the neuroscience stuff. We wanted to get some scientific opinion on where we are really. Are we along the path to the kind of technology that enables this man-machine interface that happens with the Jaegers in Pacific Rim? We reached some conclusions that I found interesting once I listened to them, so I hope you do as well, because a couple things made themselves very obvious once we started discussing everything. So get ready for the neural handshake, people. 3, 2, 1. We are doing our own neural handshake, people, and this is basically the Crimson Typhoon of podcasting. I have with me Sama of the Carry the One podcast. Hello. How you doing, Sama?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me, Keith.
Yeah, man. No, this is cool. I mean, this is a joint podcast. Again, not a whole lot of Nerdometrics stuff. For people who haven't heard my podcast before on the Nerdometrics Pacific Rim stuff, you should check it out. We went on for a while about some economic things and some timing things, but that's not what we're talking about today. Today, we are talking about the man-machine interface concept of Pacific Rim. And leading up to this, I sent Sama a text or two, and I was like, hey, man, would you be interested in doing a joint podcast where we just get together, talk a little bit about the stuff in Pacific Rim and where we are in reality compared to the fiction of Pacific Rim? And to that extent, we have a subject matter expert with us as well. We have Joey. Joey, do you want to give a little intro about yourself for the people?
Sure. So I'm a graduate student right now at the University of Utah studying neural engineering. My name is Juan Martinez, and I don't do specifically a brain-machine interface in the sense that you would see at Pacific Rim, but I do sort of am updated on the field.
Yeah, he knows a lot more than I would.
Both of you guys probably know more than almost everybody else put together, so that's pretty awesome. Both you guys have seen the film, correct?
Yeah.
I have some questions, and we can go with these questions and then see what happens from there. So my first question, a key part here is that people, through a brain-machine interface, right? I hope I'm using the terminology correctly, pilot these massive robots that are 20, 25 stories high and use this brain power to kind of control all this stuff through sensory things and motor things and shared memories and stuff. So my first question is, how far along are we right now with man-machine interfaces? Where are we right now in terms of the cutting edge of technology?
All right. Joe, you want to take this one or you want me to just chime in? Maybe we should talk about what exactly is different between what we know now about brain-machine interface and how it's currently built versus how the movie has it handled.
Sure.
Because, in the movie, right, you just sort of go you put a helmet on, sort of, and it right away connects you to the Jaeger, to the giant machine, right? But that's not really how the brain-machine interface works in the real world right now, right?
No, a lot of the machines, brain-machine interface that we do, would actually have to penetrate through the skin and into the actual brain to get any sort of access. Also, in the movie, from if I understood it correctly, I don't think it was really explained. So, it wasn't the helmet that gave them access to their nervous system. It was this sort of spinal attachment that they showed very prominently. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to me that it was not so much a brain machine interface, but like a spinal cord machine interface.
Mm-hmm. And is that any bit more or less feasible than a brain machine interface? Would both of them yield the same effect?
Well, that's a good question. So most of the signals that you're going to be getting, so most of the neural signals that you're going to be getting from the spinal cord, will be information that's going out to your limbs, to your muscles, to your viscera. So if we're talking about a machine being able to control sort of executive planning or very sophisticated things, then that's not really the place you want to put your machine interface with. However, if what you're trying to do is basically control limbs and trying to move something, then yeah, that's actually where you would want to put it.
Right. Okay, so yeah, in truth, they really nailed it, right? Because the Jaeger doesn't have, let's call it a brain, right? The brain is the people thinking and working together as a team. And then through their shared thoughts, their motor skills are what actually controls the Jaeger.
Right. So that's what I mean. That to me is where it sort of fell apart as being a brain machine interface. Because there's a big training component to the brain machine interface where, like, you sit in the, you sit down and the EEGs are put onto your head and you're told to think of an idea or emotion, think about moving to the left. And then the activity is picked up in your brain, and that is fed into the computer, and is told whenever you see this activity, it means he wants to go to the left. There's like a certain training that goes before you can even use the machine itself with your mind, right? And I didn't actually see that in the movie, where they just sort of tapped in right away and they were ready to go.
Well, yeah, any brain machine interface, the ones we use now, require a lot of essentially calibration or training. Somebody sitting with the brain machine interface connected to their brain already, and they get some sort of visual feedback of, is this working, is this not working? Then again, I mean, if you give the movie enough, creative license, they talk about the pilots going through a lot of artificial training, or what am I thinking of,
Simulated training?
Simulated training, yes. Correct. Obviously, we are not at the point right now where that could be possible, but if you can think of the simulated training forming an idea, forming some sort of serving the role as a calibrator. As the pilot is being trained, there's a program that sort of understands how his brain is already working. Because the reason that calibration is necessary is because every brain is different.
Mm.
So, where the cells or where the neurons that will be responsible, in a sense, for moving an arm will actually be, will be in a general area for every human being, but it's very specific to every single person. So in that sense, again, I think they sort of, got it.
The thing with Pacific Rim, right, there's two ways. It sounds like there's really one way to control a Jaeger. You control the movement, right? Mm-hmm. So you have these spinal interfaces that control the movement. If you have spinal interfaces that control the movement, and you even assume this whole, you need two pilots to share the load, mm-hmm. right, to control this skyscraper tall robot,
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering why the hell you even need the drift, why you even need the brain link, right? Couldn't you just have two people with the spinal interface and just have them talk to each other?
Right. You can even take it a step further and ask why you need a person in the Jaeger itself. Why not remotely control it the way we currently control robots? Like, say, like the Curiosity robot in Mars, You don't actually need a person there.
I would even go, a third step forward and say you probably don't even need a brain machine or a spinal machine interface to do this. Because the biggest, not to go on a tangent, the biggest use for brain machine interfaces right now is to create prostheses for limbs that don't exist.
Right. It's for people who are, say, quadriplegic or paraplegic, and they need a robot arm, say, to help them brush their teeth. And they can't do it themselves.
Okay. Right. So you create this brain interface, and that's where we are with that, the current developments on brain machine interfaces, right?
So those at this point, that's more where we are, trying to develop neural prostheses. They're somewhat rudimentary, but researchers have been able to at least get as far as controlling an arm, and that's a very, very useful function for people that have lost their arms.
Right, and it's not very smooth either. It's like it takes a lot of practice, right. a lot of training, and then when you see the final like product, which is pretty profound, you know, this person is just sitting on a bed and they're controlling with their mind a robot that's moving very slowly, but it's helping them, say, drink a glass of water. It may take them 20 minutes to drink that glass of water, but it's still pretty amazing. You know, you can see that we're going to go in the future towards more smoothly operated machines, you know.
At what point in the future do you think a person would be able to drink a glass of water using this brain-machine interface at what we would consider a normal speed, say 20 seconds, you know, to drink this glass of water?
Wow.
So I'm going to throw out a number.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw out. Let's just say I'm very optimistic. Let's just say 15 years.
Oh, great. I would have said 10 to 20 years. So perfect. Oh,
okay, good.
But I mean, that's not a long time. I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts on a lot of subjects, and we're 20 years away from a lot of really remarkable things that seem incredibly futuristic. I mean, I don't know, 15 years is a blip, right, in terms of development.
And actually, the biggest one of the biggest problems in sort of trying to get somebody to control an arm with their brain to pick up a glass of water isn't so much getting them to move the arm. It's getting them to have an appreciation for how much grip they have to, how much force they have to exert, yeah, to hold the glass and not crush it or drop it.
Yeah, it turns out to be the fine motor things that are a problem. Like, it's easy for a brain, and we've even trained monkeys to do this, right? It's easy for a brain to say, control an arm to go from left to right. But to go from left to right at a certain speed or to slow down right before you reach a target, those are really difficult things for us to pick up right now.
No, that makes sense. I mean, that's something in my everyday life. I call it the potato chip bag theory, right? that you get this little tiny, you know, couple ounce bag of chips for your lunch or for, you know, for a delicious snack. Who are we kidding, right? Mm-hmm. And you're trying to slowly exert the right amount of pressure to open this bag,
right,
but not result in a potato chip explosion,
right?
Right.
Right.
And that's the same thing. I can imagine how much harder it would be if your brain's trying to do it.
Right. Well, your brain is doing it, though, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
It's just, yeah, that it's,
I guess,
harder.
So really, it's no different, right?
Yeah. The hard part is, I mean, we're just trying to, you know, if you can imagine there being like a middleman between your brain and your body moving. I mean, the current middleman is really good. You know, we have no problems picking up a glass of water. You know,
well, apparently mine isn't, because I can't open a damn bag of chips.
some are better than others, right? But imagine, you know, not having access to that middleman. You have to create it yourself through this machine, through this the algorithms that we have to train. You know, it becomes really difficult to figure out what's important. How do we code it? You know,
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So I had another question down here that I think we've already answered, right? I wrote down, what is the largest piece of machinery someone can control right now using their brain? And it's basically what, like an arm? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I've seen, the biggest I've seen is an arm, maybe like a 7 foot long arm that I've seen. And I reached, this woman was in a hospital and she was able to drink a glass of water through a straw from with it, you know. But I haven't seen anything bigger than that.
Well, I mean, from an engineering standpoint, obviously building something larger than that, it's going to be more difficult. But the concept is the same. If you're talking about, you know, building trying to get control with your mind, a sort of a robot that's 1 foot tall. Obviously, it's much easier to build one that's 1 foot tall than one that's 25 stories tall.
Right.
But conceptually, if you have already the brain-machine interface and you have the software that's, you know, moving these limbs, I think the idea is the same.
So this is where I'm going to, I think theoretically the idea is the same, but there's a problem that you're hiding, and that it's a problem that comes up in the movie, which is like feedback. Like the bigger,
right,
the more, you know, imagine if you were a 20 story tall person, like a human being that's that big.
I do frequently.
Yeah, which, you know, just imagine that. So if I were to poke your foot, it will take that signal a lot longer to get from your foot to your brain, and then for you to decide, oh, I need to move my foot away from this, pointy object. And then that signal has to go from your brain back down your spinal cord to control your muscles to move your foot. That takes physical space. Like, it needs to travel a longer distance. So there's a problem of feedback, I think, in the movie, or with building a, having a brain control a larger object, because once the object moves, you need to know that it's moved, and because it's bigger, it takes longer for that information to get back to you. Does that make sense? I'm not sure if I...
Yeah, so there's a control loop. So all movement work functions under what we would call a closed loop, in the sense that we're constantly responding to the way our body is moving. Mm-hmm. So we know exactly, we know how much force to apply in one direction, how much force to apply in another one. We are constantly receiving feedback that's helping us move.
Right.
But it does create, you're right, it does create an issue as the robot gets bigger. If that feedback is getting delayed, then you sort of, now you're functioning under like a different,
Yeah, it's like trying to control the Curiosity rover. It's on Mars. It takes 14 minutes for a signal from Earth to get to it, and then 14 minutes for that signal to get back. So you could only move it a little bit at a time, wait, and then 30 minutes later, you'd be like, okay, it's moved this far, and I can see this much now. Let me move it a little bit further. It's the whole process gets lengthened.
Yeah, but isn't that an extreme example? I mean, you're talking about something that's how many...
Right, but I'm using... Yeah, you're right. It's an extreme example, but I'm using it to highlight this problem of the larger you become, the longer the signal has to travel, the more this feedback sort of breaks in a way,
No, I mean, it does make sense because anybody who's ever experimented with or uses music software and has to deal with latency for pressing a key and then hearing the sound through your monitors, it can definitely create a bit of an issue.
Right.
Right. But I mean, to some extent, I think that's something that could easily be resolved when you're designing something like a kaiju, because if you're designing,
or Jaeger.
30, Jaeger. in animals, in mammals, that is much more of an issue, simply because neurons, the way that we get signals from our foot to our brain through our spinal cord, it's through sort of neurochemical reactions and through electrical conductance. However, if you're, we can already transmit information much faster than that using just general hardware. I mean, fiber optic cables move essentially at the speed of light or somewhat slower, actually.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, if you're controlling this thing, are all the movements at the speed of light?
Right. So
exist at the speed of light, or is that not the case?
Right. That's a good point. I didn't think about that. Like that the signal from the person piloting the Jaeger to the Jaeger might be, let's just say it's as fast as the speed of light. But that still doesn't, you still have the problem of, I punch forward. The Jaeger has to move proportionally fast for me to know that I've made impact with something outside, that outside the Jaeger's body, right? Like, there's that feedback still, if I just move my foot forward as a human being, the Jaeger will take a lot longer to move his foot forward just because he's that much bigger,
Right.
So then they're like, I have to wait there and, wait for the Jaeger to finish his movement before I can start my next movement. Even if you have, speed of light processing, it's still an issue just because of the scale,
No, that's interesting, because there is one aspect of the Jaeger motion that my internal, detector went off, and that was when the Jaeger runs.
Right.
I mean, I think there might even be multiple times where the Jaeger actually runs, and that seems really cool. But then on the other hand, you're thinking like, wow, something feels off about it at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make.
So stomping around in typical, 1968 Godzilla suit fashion is much more feasible the way you're talking about it than anything that would involve a degree of speed or agility.
Right. Or reaction. Like, you have to, that's the thing. Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, that's... No, go ahead.
From my point of view, I mean, movements like walking or running are much more stereotyped than sort of more volitional muscle movements. So this experiment's been done here. If you have a cat on a treadmill and you're just sort of making it walk on, making its hind legs walk on the treadmill. If you sever the spinal cord at some point, it will that sort of the gait motion will be preserved, even though it doesn't have any actual like motor. You know, it doesn't have any control coming from the brain, right? Mm-hmm. So these, a lot of these things, are a lot of motions like, you know, gait and running, it actually, you can sort of just say program into the Jaeger, if you want to run, these are the sort of the motions that the Jaeger is going to make.
I see. So it could be like there are some built-in actions into like, you know, what we call, what you're talking about is called a central pattern generator. Like this,
right.
You put a central pattern generator into the robot, into the Jaeger's mind, or you know, into its computer, such right. that like, okay, I intend to run, therefore it's gonna run without me actually having to do the motions myself.
That gets us to what it's almost like we can make this point and then drop the mic and go home.
That's not a bad point.
If you have it's what we talked about before, right? If you have a program where you can just say execute run,
mm-hmm. right.
execute fire plasma cannon, mm-hmm. execute rocket elbow punch, you know, mm-hmm. And you don't need to do it and you don't need to be there and there doesn't need to be anybody around at all.
Yeah,
and you could just operate the whole damn thing remotely, right?
But that's not cool.
That's right. I can't really think of any, you know, when I first saw the preview for the movie, I thought they were controlling it remotely. I didn't realize they were physically inside the robot's head. You know, that was a shocker when I saw the movie.
Right. Well, I mean, what I felt when I was watching the movie is the same point that we brought up: whether there needs to be a brain machine interface or a spinal cord machine interface. Mm-hmm. As we were talking about before, we went into the issue of delay. Most of the neural engineering that we do is to recover function from people that don't have function. Mm-hmm. However, when we're talking about enhancing function, using your mind to control an arm that's much bigger than your arms, mm-hmm. I mean, we don't have anything right now, and I don't see why how soon we could even develop something like this. We don't have something right now that would actually enhance, that would be better than just, you know, something that sees how your arms are moving and makes the Jaeger move like you're moving.
Right. Mm.
So they actually have this in within the control room. Like, you know, when they're punching, they're physically, you know, moving their arms and making a fist and punching.
Right.
And they have trackers and all their movements are being tracked. Mm-hmm. So at the point where, you know, if you tap into the spinal cord and you're trying to pick up these signals that, you know, show that, you know, the pilot is punching, why don't you just use the motion of punching to actually control the Jaeger?
So I guess I just thought of an argument against this, which is it's the same reason that, you know, having a Jaeger being piloted by a human being that's inside the Jaeger, it's the same argument that you can make for why the Air Force operates the way it does. You know, why we use less drones and why most of the people are actually piloting the planes themselves, which is you're right there. You have the plane's point of view, and you can react to things from that point of view instead of from a distant point of view. Right. So
but
there is some advantage.
Pretty much the future when we break that down.
Yeah, I mean the movement is in the opposite direction. It's using less pilots and using more drones now.
No, I agree, but I can see why in the movie, I can see the logic for the idea for why you'd have a pilot. You know.
Right. I mean, it's the same. It's the same idea when people talk about space travel. Mm-hmm. Something about it's the same issue you bring up with the latency and the the maneuverability delay. And mm-hmm. the reaction times for the Curiosity rover. I read somewhere that the accumulated work that had been accomplished by all the Mars rovers. Mm-hmm. Which has been years and years of work, could have all been performed by one human crew in a week had they been able to land on Mars.
Right.
And the reason is because all these, the rovers work on, they get a set of instructions once or twice a day.
Yeah, once a day. They have 8-minute window to talk to the rover per day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's, I always like real world parallels to things like that. And for me, the real world parallel there is if you ever have a lot of things to say to someone, you call them. Mm-hmm. You don't exchange texts, right? Because it would take 45 texts to deliver the equivalent of a 5-minute phone call because of all the back and forth that you can do so quickly when you're actually talking to somebody.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Right. Or a picture, well, you know, is 1,000 words kind of thing. There's better modes of operating.
Yeah. No, that's cool. Well, let's unless you guys want to talk a little bit more about the interface side, even though we've pretty much proved that we don't need to have it, I'd still like to talk a little bit about the Neuralink side of it.
Yeah. So that's the I actually have it written down here. It's like two issues. One, brain controlling a robot. Why would you do this? And two, issue two, neural handshake. Super cool, super unrealistic.
Yeah, well, no, go ahead. Embellish on that. Super cool, super unrealistic.
Well, okay, I'm gonna break down why you can't have a neural handshake. We should maybe explain what that is for people who haven't seen the movie. So in the movie, it's for some reason, it was too big of a load on one person to control this 25-story robot. So they'd have to have...
The specific term was neural load.
There was neural load, too much neural load, which by itself is a problem. I didn't really understand. But let's just give them that there is can't. Let's just give them that. So they needed two people to share that load, and they had two brains that were connected, controlling one robot. Okay, so far so good. The problem I think with having that is if I told you guys right now not to think of a pink elephant, what's the first thing that you do?
Yeah.
Right. It's right there. Like, there's this two. The brain is just a stochastic, noisy thing that's like prone to distraction. And it's, you know, like if any one of them for a second like thought about anything, you know, it doesn't have to be as deep as they did it in the movie, where Mako was thinking about a memory she had as a child. That's a little. You don't even need to go that far. You just have to think, oh, there's a. You know, I didn't notice that the lead paint on the side is actually peeling, and then that by itself is a distraction enough for you. You know?
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean that's true. So basically, are you saying you would lose the connection?
I would say that it's too difficult to sync up two brains. Period. Hmm. You know. That would be my issue. We can talk about. I mean, people are doing this, right? There are current studies. There was one study that tried to control a simulated plane, like a simulator, where they had two people trained the same way. Like, say, if I told you go left, and you think of going left, your brain has some activity, and I can put that into the machine. This means left for person A. I do the same thing for person B. They obviously have different brain activity, but to me, it's translated the same way. And what you can do is have them control one simulator plane. And the idea is that because the signal, since it's already noisy, it'll pop up and be averaged because you have two of them now, right? So that you can have the signal to noise ratio be increased. You have more signal over the noise. So in that case, you can have two people controlling one thing. And you know, and there's some benefits to it, but it's already a very tough idea, you know.
Well, would it make more sense to only have one pilot then? I mean, if we're indulging the fact that if we're giving ourselves a couple givens, right? Okay, this can really happen. Blah blah blah. Do you think it's more realistic to assume that one person could do it than two?
Yeah, I think for sure it'd be easier. And the technology is already more developed in the real world to have one person control or even one monkey control a cursor on a screen or a small arm, you know. But when you have two, you know, unless the initial signal is so noisy, like let's pretend you're not actually in the brain but outside it, like, you know, you shaved your head and you're trying to measure through the skull, and it's a really noisy. Signal, like because of muscle movement and you have your jaw, say, you know, there's a lot of noise. Maybe having two people trained the same way might be better because you might be able to pick up that little signal and average it better because you have more signal being coincided, you know, coming together in time. That's the only benefit I would see.
Well, I mean, also, I mean, from what I understand, a lot of like Air Force or a lot of planes are flown by two pilots. Mm-hmm. Sort of like stealth bombers. And part of the idea is to reduce error. Mm-hmm. So if you have two pilots that are trying to sort of get to the same goal, one pilot is constantly sort of double-checking what the other pilot is doing.
Right.
And the idea of, I mean, not in the movie, but in the motivation generally for having two pilots is having either one control one part of the machine, the other control another part, or just to have them be sort of a redundant system. Mm-hmm. So it's much harder to fail when you have two people constantly checking for errors rather than just one pilot.
Right. So if they had, instead of the way they did it in the movie where, you know, you sort of take the right side, I take the left, if they had one person controlling the whole robot and the other person sort of keeping them on track,
right,
standing behind right. them, say, that might make a little bit more sense, I think.
Exactly what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it basically, by doing it this way, you're doubling the chance of error. Because,
mm-hmm. right.
you know, person controlling the left can just meander off mentally for a second and think of pink elephants. Right.
Mm-hmm. right. Well, I also saw the idea of neural handshake, sort of the understanding that I would have originally gotten from it, but wasn't visible in the movie, is that, you know, anybody that's played a video game, for example, there's been studies done on this. After a while, you can enter a zone of like extreme concentration,
mm-hmm. super focus.
Yes, well, you know, entering the zone and essentially going yeah, into like this sure. This mode. Any you know anybody that's played competitive video games knows what I mean by this. It's this time or this time of extreme focus where you really don't get distracted. You're purely focused on the task at hand, and you know it's actually very exhausting afterwards. But that's what I would have imagined when they said neural handshake is a way of sort of engaging both their minds into the zone where distractions are, ignored.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's probably why they had to have specific people working together, because they probably are distracted less, or like, you know, it's like playing on a basketball team, like you know, Kobe and Shaq back in the day were in the zone together. You know, it's maybe. Maybe right. that's what they were going for in the movie.
2002, Kobe and Shaq would have made excellent Jaeger pilots.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
2005, Kobe and Shaq would have made a Trojan.
Yeah. Well,
so you're actually saying that there's credence to the theory of triplets or twins or lovers.
I don't know.
Are you saying that that would make for a stronger connection, or do you think that was just a convenient thing?
Yeah, I mean, most likely it was just for the story. Like it makes more of an emotional connection if your twin brother is right there, and then we as an audience can connect with that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it would have added much, unless you want to make an assumption that somehow twins can quote unquote get into the zone better than two other guys, you know, who are just friends. You know, so I don't know if there's any credence, at least any scientific credence to it.
Yeah, I mean, I know we're stretching scientific credence to its thinnest right now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the question I just asked was basically, well, given these four things that can't possibly happen,
yeah.
in the context of that, how realistic is thing five?
Well, it's like asking, can Superman actually turn back time by spinning the Earth around? You know, like you give him the fact exactly. that he can fly and that he can take bullets to the chest. You sort of give him that. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, a given in this scenario is that there's an alien from Krypton who looks just like a human being who right. has enhanced powers in our atmosphere.
Right. Can he actually turn back time?
Special thanks again to Sama and Joey. You can check out Sama's podcast at carrytheoneradio.com. They're also on a platform called Patreon, where you can help them out, assist them with fundraising to get new and better equipment, and continue to evolve the podcast in an even more positive way. So check them out. I'll have links in the show notes.